We're busy tonight. We have two haftorahs to learn because it's a double parsha, Parshas Chukas and Balak. And I would like to connect the two haftorahs through their parshas. In what way can we connect the story of Yiftach with the prophecy of Micha? So I would do so as follows. Hashem promised Avraham the land of 10 nations. 7 of those 10 nations are constantly repeated in the Torah. We repeat 6 of them in our daily davening. Right? Kanani, Chiti, Amori, Prizi, Yevusi, and Chivi. In some places they repeat Girgashi, in some places some psukim omit Chibi, some psukim omit Girgashi, some psukim omit both. Okay, but those 7 nations are what we call the 7 Canaanite nations. There is Nagadato that Girgashi left and went south. However, Hashem told Avraham regarding 10 nations, and those 3 additional nations are Cani, Knizi, and Kadmoni. Cani, Knizi, Kadmoni. Now, we don't recognize those 3 nations. However, they, at the time that Hashem told this to Avraham, the nations that ended up inhabiting those 3 areas did not yet exist. Right? One of those nations was Edom. Of course, Edom doesn't exist. Edom is Avraham's grandson, Esav. The other one is Ammon and Moab, and of course, they don't exist either, because they're Lot's children, right? So at that time, those 3 areas were called Cani, Knizi, Kadmoni, and those 3 areas later came to be known as Edom, Ammon, and Moab. Now, at the beginning of Sefer Devarim, something that the people in our story in the Torah reading do not yet know, is that Hashem told Moshe that the lands of Ammon, Moab, and Edom are not yours. You may not inhabit them. You may not fight them. Don't attack them. If they attack you, of course, you can fight back. But then those lands have been given to Esav as an inheritance and to the children of Lot as an inheritance. It's not yours. So that's why we always speak of the 7 Canaanite nations and not the 10 Canaanite nations. When are we going to inherit all 10 is Nimosa Mashiach in the future. Okay, fair enough. So the lands of Edom, Ammon, and Moab are not to be inhabited by us. Okay, so keep that in mind from the beginning of Sefer Devarim, right? Which is ironic because the beginning of Parshas Balak, which is the second of our 2 Torah portions, has the Moabite king Balak very frightened about the Jews, right? I mean, we ourselves prophetically sang about that in the Shiras Hayam when we crossed the Yam Suf, right? We said, Chil Ochaz Yoshve Plushes. We said, Namogu kol Yoshve Kinaan, Tipola Lehem and Masova Fachad, Bidolz Racha Yudmuka Oven, right? Elei Moab Yochaze Moraad, right? We spoke about the Moabites being terrified of us. Fair enough. So Balak was terrified of the Jews, and he wanted to get the upper hand by getting a famous person to curse them, whose curses usually matter. So if Balak had known that the Jews want no part of his land, the Jews are commanded not to touch his land. So what do you want with us? It's a typical Indian that is often brought out by Mefarshim, is that Balak tells Bilam, whoever you bless is blessed, whoever you curse is cursed. So what do you have to ask him to curse the Bnei Israel? Just ask him for a blessing, right? But that's the way of the enemies. They don't really care about any issue whatsoever. They just want to hurt us, right? Okay, so here is the connection between Chukas and Balak. First of all, keep in mind that the beginning of Parshas Chukas is in the second year in the desert, and then after we finish the story of the Parah Aduma, chapter 19, the very next pasuk skips 38 years. Okay, the very next pasuk is the death of Miriam, that takes place right before we enter the land of Israel. Okay, I shouldn't say right before, but a year before. All right, she died in the 10th of Nisan. We entered the land of Israel exactly a year later. Exactly a year later after she died. So that there's quite a bit of time in between. Right, so the Balak story takes place towards the end of our 40-year stay in the desert. And we were about to be told not to touch the land of Moab, Ammon, and Edom. Here is the thing you've been waiting for, the connection to the first Haftarah. In the story of Yiftach, the Ammonites challenge Yiftach by saying that we are currently inhabiting some of their land. Now, if you've ever looked at a picture of the land that Israel inhabited in its first 500 years as a nation, you'd be amazed. About maybe 10% of the current Israeli population lives in those areas. Because most of the first 500 years, we lived in what's today Yehuda and Shomron. Not in the coast, not anywhere near the coast. The entire coast was considered to be controlled by Sidonites, the Philistines, the Phoenicians, the and Canaanites. Right? We controlled the heartland. So we did control the areas of Ammon and Moab. How did we come to be in control of the lands of Ammon and Moab if God told us that we're not supposed to conquer them? Answer? This Haftorah. This Haftorah gives the answer to that question. Okay? Now, we're not going to read it this Shabbos, but the fact is that this Haftorah could quote right out of the Torah reading. This, last week in Parshas Korach, we had one line out of the Torah portion. Did I take any travel expenses? I didn't even charge them for one donkey. Right? That Shmuel seems to quote from Moshe. Right? I didn't even take any travel expenses. So that's a quote. Right? A direct quote from in the Haftorah from the Torah portion. Well, Chevra, this Haftorah doesn't just quote one, a two psukim. The whole story of how we came to inhabit the lands of Ammon is repeated in the Haftorah. Yiftach had to have Parshas Chukas open in front of him in order to make his best argument against the Ammonites. What is that argument?
It was koshered up for us.
Yeah, it was koshered. That land was koshered by Sichon and Og. Okay? You see, Sichon and Og conquered the lands of Ammon and Moab. So when we were leaving Egypt, actually this was the time where we were starting towards the end of our stay in the desert, and we were drawing close to entering the promised land, and we had to pass through certain areas controlled by Sichon, Og, Edom. And we just asked them for safe passage. Right? You know, they knew that we had a reputation of being supported by a very powerful God. Right? And Moshe, especially his entreaty to the Edomites, Moshe said, "We won't even drink any Mebe'er." Look in the Torah portion, the first of the 2 weeks Torah portions. "We will not drink Mebe'er, and whatever we drink, we'll pay for." So what do you mean we won't drink Mebe'er? They had a Be'er. right? They had a well according to tradition, came to us in the merit of Miriam. That's why when she died, there was no water. So we had a bear. So, no, what Moshe was saying, says Rashi, is that we want to pass by your land, and we also want to give you the benefit. We want your people to have Hana'a because we're passing through your land. We want them to feel, hey, it's good that the Jews are here. They're going to all our shops. They're buying groceries. And they're paying for water. Cold, if you can. All right. So I remember when we used to spend the summers in Tannersville. So they would ask me sometimes to speak between Mincha and Maariv on Shabbos. And I remember one, this goes back to, I think, 1984, 1985, maybe 1983, I think, even, where I spoke, it was Parshas Chukas, I mentioned this Rashi, and I gave a little musar because, the Jews in Tannersville, Mamish, they take over the whole city, and Hunter also, in the summer. And they open up all kinds of Jewish stores, Jewish restaurants, and Jewish groceries. So I said, okay, look, you want to have your kosher pizza, you want to have your kosher cheeses, and you want to have your challahs, and you want to have your kosher wines, things that that the local A&P is likely not to carry. Fair enough, but you don't have to sell cereal, you don't have to sell paper goods, right? Let them have at the local A&P some hanah by the fact that the Jews are here, and I quoted from this Rashi. Then I turned to Bankus, right? It didn't go over. So, they said, Rashi says that when they passed through the lands of the Edomites, they said, listen, we're ready to give you all kinds of benefits by just allowing us to walk through. There was a time where Jews weren't invited in the hotels around that area. I just heard that the Jews bought the largest hotel in Tannersville. It's called the Villa Velosa. Jews just bought it. They're turning into a kollel. But when the Jews are there, they should give the hanah like Moshe said to the Edomites. But it didn't work for them either, because the Edomites refused and said, "We'll come out to you with the sword if you try to pass by our land," right? So Sichon and Og did the same thing. Now, we were told not to fight back to Edom, but we were never told not to fight back to Sichon and Og. So Sichon and Og actually came out to meet us with arms. They went out to fight with us. Right, we can't just sit like sitting ducks. If you ever read in the Sefer HaMakabim, also known as Sefer Chashmonaim, it says that the Greeks fought against us on Shabbos, and we didn't know that we were allowed to fight on Shabbos, and we lost the first battle because the Jews didn't want to pick up arms on Shabbos. And then they realized that they can't, they're committing suicide if they fight on Shabbos. If the enemy fights us on Shabbos and we don't fight back, that must be a Gemara in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Yotes. I'd read it to Afilu B'Shabbos. But here, if the Sichon and Og come out to meet us with arms, how could we not fight back? And we did, and we killed Sichon and Og, and we took over their land. What land did Sichon and Og control? The Cainy and Knezi, Ammon and Moab. By that time, Ammon and Moab were countries and nations like we were. Okay? So by conquering Sichon and Og in Parshas Chukas, we came to control the lands of Ammon and Moab. Now you know the topic of our Haftarah. The Ammonites came to Yiftach with a taina. We want our land back. Okay. So Yiftach quotes from our Torah reading all about how we came to possess it, and we're certainly not going to relinquish it. So the Ammonites came out to fight us. And in that war, things were not going well. And Yiftach made a deal with God and said, God, if you turn the tides of this war, then upon my safe arrival, the first thing that emerges from my house. So he describes what should happen to this thing in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, in Perek Yud Aleph. He says, "V'haya hayotze asher yetze midal se beisi l'krasi b'shuvi b'shalom ibnei Amon." If I am indeed successful in the end, turn around this battle. "V'haya l'Hashem," that thing shall be unto God. "V'ha'alisihu olah." Now, we might have discussed this, I think, once before in a different context. I just want to review this. Is that we all know what happened, is that his daughter came out. He was very upset when he saw her. She was coming out to greet him with musical instruments and tambourines and dancers and singers. And he's very upset because he realizes that she fulfilled this. She was the first thing that emerged from his house. Now, you may know a Gemara in Maseches, the beginning of Maseches Tainis, that speaks about three people in Tanakh who made these kind of deals with God that were not properly set. Right? The first one was Avraham's servant. What was bad about his deal?
Could have been an ugly girl.
Yeah, the Gemara says,
only because she did kind things to the animals. That doesn't mean that, you know, she was like a good wife also, like a good person.
Yeah, so that's the Ran's explanation of the Gemara, why it's not Nichush. But the Gemara says, what happens if someone just not suited for Yitzchak would have come out, right? Okay, but he got a good answer. He got Rivka. The second one was Shaul. Shaul said, whoever kills Goliath gets to marry my daughter. So the Gemara says, what could go wrong there?
Someone who was
not suitable.
Was not suitable. Yeah.
Also not suitable. Both of these involve marriage. A mamzer, an eved, what happens if someone not suitable for a king's daughter is going to kill Goliath? Right? This is not a good
But Rabbi Schwartz, maybe they were just so desperate that it didn't even matter.
That is probably what it is. Shaul could not find a single person and had to give some kind of incredible incentive. That's the pshat. But still, the Gemara says, it tells him, nonetheless, he may still have done it, even if he saw this Gemara. But he still says that it could have gone wrong. In the end, Shaul himself tried to show it was wrong, that he had the halachic equivalence of a mamzer by being descended from a Moabite. Back to our story. But that's for a different time. That's a Gemara in Yevamos. The Tosfos points out there happens to be a third person in Tanakh who made a marriage dependent on something like this. That was Kalev ben Yefuna, who said, whoever conquers Kiryat Sefer gets to marry my daughter, Ochsa. And, okay, the same problem, right? How do you know someone would be appropriate, Yuchas, to marry your daughter? Okay. So the fourth case, or the third case, is Yiftach. And the Gemara, in all the other cases, mentioned the worst case scenario. And in Yiftach, the worst case scenario is not as bad as what actually happened. What's the Gemara's worst case scenario?
The one?
The pig that comes out.
Yeah, he says, Yiftach, what's the matter with you? What kind of deal are you making? That the first one who gives you and your camels will marry Yitzchak. What if, I'm sorry, the first person that comes out of your door, Yiftach, you'll make a korban to Hashem. What if a pig or a dog or a camel would come out? You're going to offer those things to God? Doesn't the Gemara know that worse than those three things did come out? There's no death penalty for killing a pig on God's altar. It's misa b'dei shamatan b'dei shamayim, but not that death penalty by the courts, but I assure you, if you kill a human being on God's altar, you suffer the death penalty. Right? So why does the Gemara skip the actual eventuality and settle for a less worst case scenario? If not for the possibility that Yiftach never meant to kill a human being when he said those four words. Are you looking at them? V'hayol Hashem, v'ha'alisihu Olah. Whatever comes out of my house, if it's a person, shall be for God. If it's an animal, then I'll bring it up as an Olah. And then we have to see, what does it mean to be for God? Right? There's nothing in the text that indicates that Yiftach killed his daughter. What the text does say is he fulfilled his vow regarding his daughter because she insisted. I assure you that if I make a vow to kill someone else, there's no way that that person has to submit to my what I say. Of course not. Right? The only reason why he did is because she insisted. She said, Dad, you're the leader of Israel now. Well, what's it going to be like if leaders of Israel make vows to God and they don't keep it? You better keep it. She didn't even ask him what the vow was. She just insisted, you better keep the vow. All right? So it says he kept his vow. He sent her away to live in seclusion. Her friends mourned the fact that she never got married. And it manages to say in the text three times that she never knew a man. She died having never known a man. She never got married and she lived for the rest of her life never knowing a man. So notice this vow takes away from marriage. The other three have to do with getting married, right? So that's Ibn Ezra's interpretation that this is what she meant. It seems to fit with the Gemara. Okay. Ramban does not like Ibn Ezra's Perush because the idea that to be unto God, the Hayol Hashem, means that you have to disappear and go into seclusion is a Christian idea, not a Jewish idea. Right? To go to a cloistered area and to live in seclusion in order to be holiest, the holiest you can be, is not a Jewish idea. Ramban says, and the proof is from Shmuel Hanavi, Shmuel's mother said that he would also be holy unto God. And yet, he lived within the community. He had children. Right?
What about Bitul Neder?
What about, was that?
Oh, Bitul, yeah. What about Bitul Neder? I mean, you do call Nidre every year.
Yeah, Father Tosfos asks your question. Tosfos in Maseches Tainis cites a Tanchuma in Parshas Pinchas that says that Pinchas and Yiftach were playing a game of not just politics, but I would say of arrogance.
But why did he need the Kohen Gadol for Bitul Neder?
He didn't, He knew that it was a possibility. It's a tough, strong kasha. One that I assure you was asked on that page of Gemara by Tosfos. Tosfos says that they were both punished. Yiftach and Pinchas were both punished for their intransigence about trying to resolve that story. I prefer to say that he sent her away to live in seclusion, even with Ramban's objection, because in all fairness to Ibn Ezra, Ibn Ezra is not saying that it's a Jewish idea to live in seclusion in order to reach holiness. Ibn Ezra is suggesting that Yiftach thought that to be holy unto God, you must live in seclusion. Yiftach was mistaken. Are you more okay with the fact that Yiftach slaughtered his daughter on the altar? That's not a mistake. However you read the story, Yiftach made a terrible mistake, either by sending away his daughter to fulfill what he thought was holiness, Bahiyol Hashem, or that he felt he had to keep his promise and slaughter a human being. However you slice that, his daughter, Yiftach, is doing something wrong, right? Okay, so that is our Haftorah. Yiftach was indeed quite successful in not only in conquering the Ammonites, but in successfully convincing his people that they were justified in controlling their land. I close with a piece of Musar, but you really have to concentrate on this Rashi in order to fully absorb the message I'm trying to impart. You probably all know that the first Rashi al HaTorah, first Rashi's statement in his commentary to the Torah, is a very Zionistic kind of statement. Rashi knows that the people reading Bereishis Bara Elokim for the first time expect very shortly to go to the land of Israel. Right? They'd been in Egypt for 210 years, and now it's time to enter the promised land. And they also surely know that there are 31 kings who live there. There are other people who live there. It's 1948. It's time, you know, where we're looking for, we agreed to a partition plan. And there are some people who live in those areas. Now, we're going to offer them the opportunity to live in our midst, but we're coming in, right? So Rashi says that the reason why we have to know about Bereishis is because the nations of the world will always say, Listim Atem. You know what that means? Mm-hmm. Right? Listim Atem. Sheganaftem es haaretz shel Zayin Amamim. You stole the land from the seven nations. You stole the land of the Palestinians. Never mind that there is no such thing as Palestinians. Palestinians are Jews, if anything. Right? If you were a Jew with an Israeli passport in 1945, it said Palestine on it. You were a Palestinian. Look at any weekly magazine, Newsweek, Time, in the first and second week of June 1967, the words Palestinian do not appear. Well, they didn't exist at the time. Okay? No one thought of creating such a state for 19 years when Egypt and Jordan controlled those areas.
Rabbi Schwartz, actually, Paris made this word proper. Paris. It was maybe not invented by Paris, but Paris started to use it all the time.
Yeah.
I'm a witness to it.
I know.
Yes.
We wanted very much to have because
the people 20, very often
23rd Arab state in the Middle East. I know they wanted very much to. Okay.
It's part of his trip, you see, at that time. Yeah, that was
okay.
Because some people say, "Oh, it is the KGB, the Soviet." Yes, maybe, but enforced this word. Paris. I know it very well. He started to use it everywhere.
Okay. So we created
story about.
All right, so the first Rashi al HaTorah says that the nations of the world will always say Listim Atem. So what do the Jews have to take to heart? God gave us this land. You don't have to justify anything else. Just God gave us this land. It's God given. We're humane about how we control the land, but God gave us the land. And Rashi quotes a pasuk in Tehillim that if the nations of the world say, Listim Atem, you stole the land, remember this pasuk. Now listen to the pasuk. It's crucial that you get this pasuk properly. Pasuk is in Perek Kuf Yud Aleph in Tehillim, and it says, Koach ma'asov higid la'amo loseis lohem nachlas goyim. Again, Koach ma'asov higid la'amo loseis lohem nachlas goyim. God demonstrated his immense power in the creation of the universe, and he tells us about it in order to give us the land of other nations. It's his land. He gave it to us. He took it from us. Gave it to Nebuchadnezzar. Took it from him. Gave it to Persia. Took it from them. Right? God gives and takes. So, but if you think about what is the agenda of this Rashi, The agenda of this Rashi is that if the Goyim say to us, listim atem, right? If the Goyim say, you stole this land from others, then remember this pasuk. So here's where I have a problem with Rashi. Rashi, if this pasuk is supposed to be an answer to the Goyim saying, listim atem, pasuk doesn't make sense. Listen carefully and please tell me why. The pasuk says, koach ma'asav higid la'amo l'seis lahem nachlas goyim. As soon as you hear the fourth word, you hear there's something wrong. If the whole point of Bereishis is to have an answer to the goyim who say, listim atem, the pasuk should have said, listen carefully in Hebrew, koach ma'asav higid la'amim l'seis la'amo es nachlasam. Who needs this message?
The Jews.
The Jews need this message. I don't care what the Goyim think. Jews need this message. The message is, Koach Ma'asav Yigid La'amo. The nations of the world will never consider that you have the rights and title to this land if you don't think so. Right? Anyway, the Semites controlled the Middle East from the time of the flood. Chamites, which is part of Canaan is part of Cham, controlled Africa. Yefet controlled Europe. What was Cham doing so far up north in Canaan? Because Kovash es ha'aretz mizaro shel shem, says Rashi again on the pasuk, Ba'knani oz ba'aretz. The Canaanim were by then in the land, by the time Avram got there, but they weren't always there. We were there first. So we can control the land. They take it from us. And when we're coming to take it back, then they call in the UN. They call in the, listing. Right? So Rashi was a great Zionist, but perhaps one of the greatest Zionist speeches in Tanakh is Yiftach's speech to the Amorites of why we were justified in having this land. Okay? It relates to Parshas Chukas. I'm halfway finished, so let's now go to the Haftorah of Balak. What does this have to do with Balak? So it has to do with the following. Ibn Ezra, introducing the Parsha, wonders the following. He says, do you think that Bilam is the only person in biblical times to curse B'nai Israel? Can you imagine that there were probably many, many... I mean, look, the Jews comprise between 1% and 2% of the population of America, yet are victims of 60% of bias attacks in America. You hear that? 60%. 6 out of every 10 bias attacks in America this past year were against Jews. And yet we're only between 1% and 2% of the population. Do you think that Bilam was the only person to curse the Jews in the time of the Torah? Why is this story even in the Torah? Who cares? God, you're the one who makes the curse count or not. Let him curse. So what? Don't make it count. Who cares? You think the Jews are going to care? Let this jerk and let this idiot curse away and wave some feathers and blow some smoke in the air. So what? You're God. Make it not count. Surely you're not going to be swayed by this illegitimate schlub who wants to curse innocent people. Right? So Ibn Ezra answers this question as follows. Had Bilam given permission to curse B'nai Israel, had word got around that he cursed us, the Israelites would have attributed the fact that we're not allowed to conquer the land of Moab to his curse. And then possibly that it extended to Amon also. Get it? If a Moabite someone hired by the Moabite king gets to curse us, and then a few months later, God tells us, you can take all the surrounding lands, but not the land of Moab, They're going to say, oh my goodness, look at that. Bilaam's curse is what caused this. Now, God can probably deal with that, but we wouldn't. Right? For good measure, I might add that at the end of the parsha, there's this terrible story with Peor. Right? You know what I'm talking about? The seventh Aliyah. This really terrible story of the Israelites whoring after one of the most despicable, disgusting, outrageous Avodah Zarahs of the ancient world. Right? Peor. In fact, the whole point of this Avodah Zarah was to worship it in as absurd a way. Just do anything absurd as you can do. What's the most absurd you can get? Just do that and do that. Okay?
Defecating.
Yeah. That's as absurd as it gets. Maron Sanhedrin says that the Jews were so good at it. They did things that even the practitioner didn't do. Right? So if Bilaam had been given permission to curse, then the Jews might have blamed their activity with Peor and said, we were helpless. We couldn't help ourselves. Bilaam's curse made us do it. You get it? So Hashem said, I'm not going to let him curse B'nai Yisrael. I'm going to turn it into a blessing. Right? I'm sure the ancient Israelites were cursed every Monday and Thursday by someone. But this particular curse, had it been able to go through, you can tell, by the way, from his blessings, what his curses were going to be. Right? Each curse was turned around on its polar head. Okay? So, by the way, one additional interesting archaeological point is that in the ancient world, when you fought a battle, it was very important to have good soldiers, good weapons. You had to know the terrain. You had to have good generals. But one of the most important things that ancient armies considered when fighting a war was to have a specialized, successful, with an excellent record, with 4 stars or more, cursor. You know what I mean? A cursor. Someone who goes on your side, beats drums, and psychs out the other side, and waves feathers, and holds up his arms or whatever, you know, like sort of like to gain support, like what Moshe does for B'nai Yisrael, hold up a flag or something. Only here, it's not something to give your soldiers strength. It's to psych out the other soldiers. Oh no, they got Bilaam on their side. Now, in pshat, what made Bilaam so successful? Imagine every battle being a horse race.
Wasn't Bilaam instrumental in Sichon or Og's conquerings?
Yes. Rashi brings that down in the beginning. Yes. But imagine a horse race. What do experts who bet on horses do before betting on a horse race? They don't just put down, you know, they try to get inside stories. They try to find out which horse just is not feeling well. Some of them bribe some of the jockeys to see how is this horse feeling today, right? So Bilaam was the best statistician in the ancient world, where he was like an actuary. He would do all the research. He would do all of the preliminary preparations to make his best guess on which side would win, and he'd sell himself to that side. People would fight over who gets Bilaam on their side to curse. Right? So Balak is ready to pay him top dollar for this particular case. Right? Get this? You want to hear something amazing? The Akkadian word for this occupation I'm going to phonetically spell it in English. B-A-R-U-M. Which is shockingly close to this man's name. Okay, R and L, you know, come from the same part of the throat, the mouth. R and R and L are interchangeable in Tanakh. Okay, and N also. Right? So it's interesting. It could be that Bilam was did this for a living. He sold himself like a whore to the highest bidder in order to psych out the other side. Right? Okay. Look, I would say there was once a war that we fought where someone on our side also wanted to gain this kind of psych out the other side advantage. What am I talking about? Can you figure
Benedict
it out?
Shaul.
Benedict Arnold.
I'm being a little cryptic.
Not Shaul.
The B'nai Eli. The sons of Eli, by taking the ark to battle.
Oh.
Wanted to psych out the other side, who would consider the Jewish ark, right, to be something that gives them an unfair advantage. But the B'nai Eli sinned in not realizing that if they're not behaving properly, the ark has no power whatsoever. It's just a box of wood and gold. Okay? So now I'd like to show you how Balak and the Haftorah of Pinchas, Haftorah of Chukas, dovetail. Right? Because if the story had not been told, the story of Bilam's curses had not been told, the Jews would have thought that the command not to control, not to attack, not to Metzar, not to give any trouble to the Ammonites and Moabites, he was the direct result of his curse. If not for his curse, we would have been able to control their land. All right? That is the basic point of the Haftorah Fukas, which we will lay next year, because next year is a leap year. Okay. Micha is not the only book of the prophets that mentions, Bilam is not the only book of the prophets that mentions Bilam. Okay. But he's the only one who actually mentions him more than just in passing. Right? He mentions what Bilam did. Okay. In fact, here's another interesting question we can ask on the second of this 2 weeks Parshios. Is why doesn't Parshas Balak tell us what Bilam's role was in the story at the end of the Parsha? Why doesn't Parshas Balak tell us that Bilam was behind that story? So you may have a question on what I just asked. Your question may be, how do you know that Bilam did have a role in that?
It says it later on.
Because it says it later on in Parshas Matos that the Jews killed Bilam because of his role with Baal Peor. So my question now returns. Why didn't Parshas Balak mention that role? Okay, but just to strengthen the question, is that our Haftorah, Micha, does mention Bilam's role in the Shitim Aragilgal. Okay? Right? That's where the story took place, in Shitim. Right? So, that just fortifies the question. If Micha is correct, and that Pasuk later in Sefer Bamidbar is telling us the accurate depiction of what Bilam did, the question returns. You know, they say, what was he doing in the battle there? Because he came to pick up his salary. Right? It's true, Bilam had no claims on Bilam to get a house full of money for cursing them, because he didn't end up cursing them. Right? Okay. So, but he did want to get paid for harming 24,000, killing 24,000 Jews. You know, in the wake of the Egel, 3,000 Jews perished. But in this story, at the end of Parshas Balak, 24,000, mostly from Shevet Shimon. Because we see it, you know, just right afterwards, Shevet Shimon is the, by less than half of the next largest tribe, the next smallest tribe. Right? Mostly died from Shimon. Right? Their own head of tribe was involved. Okay? So Micha says that Ami zechorna mayat Balak melech Moav uma ana oso Bilam ben Beor minashitim aradil golaman das tzikos Hashem. To know that after all this time, it's the end of the 40 years stay in the desert. After all this time, you're still with shtus. Gemara says, why is it called shitim? So Rabbi Eliezer says, because that's where it was. Yeshua says, no, because of shtus. Some shtus got into their heads to do what they did. No, it wasn't shtus. It was Gilui Arayos. Yodim hayu Yisrael shei mamish b'avodah zarah. The Jews knew that the b'avodah zarah was nonsense. Surely Peor was nonsense. But it did give them a free rein to avodah zarah, before Hesha even. So they ran after it. Take a look in Rashi. He'll tell you all how the Moabite Midianite women enticed the Jews. Okay. So Bilam did have a role, but if it had been listed in the parasha itself, we would have done something keen, what I said before, about 15 minutes ago. We would have blamed all of that on Bilam. No. The Torah is not even going to tell you what Bilam's role was in that. Because Bilam may have enticed us, but we're still responsible for our own actions. Don't blame it on Bilam. Even though, you know, he came to get paid for it because he was the one who incited it. But we're still responsible. Torah is going to give us the fact later. And the prophet Micha stresses it here. Okay? And then Micha does something no other prophet does. He mentions the role of Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam. Okay. Aaron, Moshe, and Miriam. Okay. Of course, Aaron accompanies Moshe quite a bit, certainly all over the place in the redemption story, but he's also quite present in the recitation of many mitzvahs. Miriam is very active in redemption and slightly after the redemption itself. Right? A lot of midrashim about her role in the redemption. Right? And the fact that right after she died with thirst of water made Chazal consider that the refreshment we got in the desert came from Har Zechus. Right? Okay, and of course we have that unfortunate story where Miriam slanders her brother and God's response. Okay, we have a mitzvah in the Torah, Zechori Sashira Sarshim Miriam, but there are potatoes from the Mitzrayim. We have to remember what God did to Miriam. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs according to Ramban. Okay, so here is where Micha, he refers to the role and the leadership role in the desert played by all three of these characters, right? So Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, because each one of them had a merit for an essential purpose in the desert. Moshe for the food, Miriam for the refreshment, and Aaron for the protection from the elements. Okay, there is a medrash called Medrash Divrei Hayomim de Moshe, the Chronicles of Moshe. If anybody has a Torah Shlema for the beginning of Parsha Shmos, I think it's about page 50, 52, 53, around there, Right, I'll tell you where to find it on the pasuk Vayilchish mi beis Levi Vayikachas bas Levi. It gives you the entire two chapters, both first two chapters of a book called Divrei Hayamim de Moshe, the Chronicles of Moshe. It starts with the marriage of Amram to Yocheved, and in that Divrei Hayamim de Moshe, it tells you most of it is dedicated to the first two chapters, understandably, to Miriam's prophecies, her early prophecies. The fact that her parents would give birth to a boy who would save the name Israel. And that's why she's called Achos Aaron, when she was referred to as Miriam Anavia, because Aaron was alive, Moshe wasn't. She started giving prophecy only when she was Aaron's sister, not Moshe's sister. The prophecy was about the birth of Moshe. Right? Okay, so a lot of Midrashim come out of that, and that's really an excellent collection of everything Miriam in that early time. Okay, and Micha is the one who picks upon these three personalities. Why? Why Micha? What's happening now that makes Micha make reference to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam? So allow me to suggest the following as Micha draws a close to his book. Okay, Micha is the author of one of the great famous exhortations called Hatznei Aleches Im Hashem. You should walk humbly or modestly before God. Okay, he says, what does God ask of you? That you should just love Mishpat and do tzedakah and walk humbly before God. Okay, so what is happening at the time of Micha is really something that is very similar to our experience in the desert, exile. You know, the Jews in the desert were hoping shortly in Parshas Baloscha to be in the land of Israel. And then there's setback after setback, one after the other. One just a few days apart from the other, one right after the other. Until they're all stuck there and they're all going to die in the desert. The Jews living at the time of Micha were told that they were flirting with exile. In fact, Micha himself in chapter 3 predicts the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Tzion sadete choresh v'yishalayim v'yim tiyeva harabayis v'bamos yo. Right? Beginning of chapter 3. The Temple Mount will be a place of utter destruction. You may recall this came up in the context of a Yirmiyahu Haftorah sometime before, is that when the Jews tried to kill Yirmiyahu for predicting the destruction of the temple, what saved his life at the last minute was that Gedaliah ben Achikam's father came in and said that we should not kill Yirmiyahu for predicting the destruction of the temple. He's not the first one to predict that. Micha HaMorashni, a very rare thing where one prophet's book quotes another prophet by name and mentions his prophecy word for word. Tzion Sodete Choresh, Yerushalayim Yim Tiyeh, V'har Habayos V'bomos Yar. Okay. So that saved Yirmiyahu's life. So Micha is living at a time where predictions are being rolled out for the destruction of Yerushalayim, the destruction of the king, the destruction of the land, the exile of the people. And here Micha wants to mention these three leaders for whom we merited the return to the land. But tragically, the three of them actually never made it in. Three of them died in the desert. So if you want to be justified, if you want to be have the merit and the benefit of entering the land of Israel, then you must incorporate what these three in their leadership meant for Klal Yisrael. Okay. Remember at the end of Parshas Shlach, I mentioned two weeks ago that right after they were told that they would die in the desert, they were given three mitzvahs. Libations, challah, and tzitzit. Libations, challah, tzitzit. in order to teach the Jews that you can stay. Micha is trying to tell the people of Yehuda, you do not need to repeat the sins of the northern kingdom. You are not destined to share their fate of exile. You can turn things around. If you follow Mishpat, you give tzedakah and hatznei aleches. Right? There are those who try to, you know, there's a Gemara in Makkos that says that the whole Torah was encapsulated in these three things. Yeah, because the Mishpat is Moshe. Ve'ele mishpatim asher tasim lifneim, teach them the mishpatim. The tzedakah is Aharon, teaches them how to do chesed. And Atznei Aleches is Miriam. So these three leaders exemplify what we need to do in order to hold on to the land and in order to deserve our redemption. You see, the Jews in Parsha Shlach felt unequal to the task of deserving to make it into the land and deserving staying there. Here we have a bear following us in the desert. What do we need? In Israel, we have to deserve the rain. Here we have man that falls. There we have to deserve the crops to succeed. Here we have protection from the elements. There it's parched land. Who knows? It could be famines. So Hashem says, yeah, those things will happen. They will happen intermittently. They will happen for reasons that sometimes you can explain, sometimes you can't. It didn't take too long for us to become so dependent, like children, so that we couldn't even fathom entering the land. So Hashem tells us, you have Miriam, the libations, you have Moshe, the Mun, and you have Aaron, the tzitzis. You do these things when you get to Israel, and you'll deserve the things you get here in the desert on your own. Not as a gift and a handout like a child. You deserve them. You worked for them. So that's why I submit to you that Micha mentions these three leaders to plug into the time of the 40 years in the desert where we would need to deserve entering the land. And Micha wants to teach his people how to deserve holding on to this land and not following in the paths of the northern tribes who had just been exiled by the Assyrians. Okay, Chevra, that's Hukas and Balak. Are there any questions? Yes, Leon?
Yes, I'm getting confused because Yiftach is conquering Ammon. Doesn't the Torah somewhere around here say that we're not supposed to bother either Moab or Ammon?
Yeah, that's what we said earlier.
If they don't, bother you.
That's what we said earlier. It was cleansed by Sihon and Og.
That's we conquered them, but isn't it after that?
No, Sihon and Og conquered it from Ammon and Moab. We never took land from Ammon and Moab.
But later on, I thought we're supposed to, after entering the land, leave Moab and Ammon alone.
Yeah, well, whatever we took from Sihon and Og, we were going to keep. I mean, that's an interesting discussion amongst some Mefarshim. What would have happened to that land if Reuven and Gad never asked for land on that side of the Yarden? So I've heard two very different interpretations of what would have happened. Now, who knows? It didn't happen. One is that we would have given it back to Ammon and Moab.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Sihon and Og to speak of. We conquered them. We would have given it back to Ammon and Moab. But you understand, it's not Ammon and Moab's land. It was Sihon and Og's land. Sihon and Og, while we were in Egypt for 210 years, took that land from Ammon and Moab, right?
Uh-huh.
And then when we were about to enter the land, they attacked us. Uh-huh. And while attacking us, we conquered them and took their land. Sort of like what Jordan did in the Six-Day War.
Right.
We told them, stay out of this. This is not your battle. This is against Syria and Egypt. Stay out.
Right.
It turned out that it's better that they entered the war. But what made them enter the war? Nasser's ridiculous announcements that the tanks are rolling into Tel Aviv.
Right.
So Jordan says, hey, I want to get some of that.
Right.
We have communiques of him saying, this is the lovely King Hussein, He said, kill every man, woman, and child you run into in Jerusalem.
Really? He said that?
Yeah, they have him on they have him recorded saying, kill every single man, woman, and child.
Wow.
So anyway, so that's how we came to control their land, but not by taking it from them. So if Reuben and Gad had not asked for that land, we would have just given it up, give it back to Ammon and Moab. We don't need this.
Right.
I much prefer a second interpretation of what we would have done had Reuben and Gad not asked for that land. A much more obvious thing, which is distribute it to all 12 tribes.
Yeah, would have been right, part of the right.
That ended up happening, after all, by not having Reuben and Gad on the west side of the Yarden. The other 10 tribes got more land than they would have gotten.
Right.
Chava, you have a question? No?
Rabbi Schwartz, I have a feeling that Miriam was much more independent concerning Moshe than Aharon. She was somehow very active, and it looks that she did not ask Moshe's permission for her activities sometimes.
Yeah, okay, you know, there's a lot written about Miriam on this topic. You know, she's of course the one who saved Moshe's life, right? There is no Moshe without Miriam. Not just once, but convincing, you know, midrashically convincing her parents to remarry. There is no Moshe even in existence without Miriam.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's no Moshe past infancy without Miriam.
No, that's true. But she always felt that she did great every time. You see,
well, okay.
That's why she criticized him also. It she comes from this feeling that
yeah.
She was somehow equal and very important in all this story.
Mm-hmm.
You see, well, okay, maybe I know.
Could be. Yeah. Well, everybody have a great week. Wednesday night we have the Minchas Chinuch at 8 p.m. And next week we have, wow, next week is already Pinchas, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great Haftorah. Okay. Now, wait a second. Next week is already the 3 weeks?
Huh? No, the, let me see, is it a week from this Sunday?
No. Yeah, this year, because Shiva Sarvatamos is on a Sunday. I think we're reading Matos and Masse separately. Because we have to have 3 weeks of Haftorahs. I know, I'll look at the calendar. Whatever it is, we'll do the right one. So next week, I do believe next week, because tomorrow's only the 5th of Tammuz. So next week will be the 12th, and Shabbos is the 16th. So Shabbos will be the regular Pinchas Haftorah. Right? Which will be from the story of Eliyahu. Okay, we'll have a good time with that.
Rabbi?
Yes?
What is Atne Alechas?
I'm sorry, say this again, I'm sorry?
Atne Alechas, you said? From Miriam, Atne Alechas?
Hatsne Alechas.
Oh, Hatsne Alechas.
Hatsne, okay, what is that?
Hatsne, it's from the word sneus. Sneus means things that are hidden and reserved and covered and... Right, sonua means a person who is reserved, modest, humble.
Rabbi, was Esar of conquering Moab and Ammon stopped after Sancheiriv?
The Esar is. It's genealogical, it's not geographical.
So it's okay to conquer Amman.
Correct. Now remember, David conquered Rabat Ammon.
Uh-huh.
Right? Mm-hmm. He was Yochid or not, but so yes, there is. There's discussion among some of the Mefarshim whether this is a Mamish of Mitzvah Saseh, like it's Kibush Aretz, it's Kibush Amalek. And there's a negative commandment. Don't conquer the land of Ammon and Moab. But there is no Ammon and Moab anymore. Right? I mean, there's a discussion in the Gemara about an Ammonite convert in the time of the Talmud. Okay, everybody.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
Can I mention that Wednesday is the end of regular registration for the shofar class?
This Wednesday already?
Yep.
Okay.
And then the class starts a week from that.
Okay, get on board.
Okay.
Okay, everyone.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everybody. Be well.
Good night. Thank you.
Go to bye.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Bye.
Allie, Sheila, Maury, Sarah, Sue, Jesse.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Great. And everyone, Bofar, Bavane, and Paul, Marshall, Yaakov, Jesse. Hey, everybody. Good night.